Welcome to this episode of Modern Practice, the podcast where you get a special curbside consult from the front lines of healthcare. I'm Dr. Tom Villanueva, and today we're hearing from another Vizient member that's developing leading practices in the battle against COVID-19. From Miriam Hospital, part of the Lifespan system in Providence, Rhode Island, Drs. Dean Roy and Maria Ducharme describe their work in surge planning, use of PPE, deploying scarce resources effectively, and key principles they use to promote a sense of safety and hope in this time of crisis. My colleague, Lindsay Mayer, Senior Director of Vizient's Collaborative Program, recently talked to both Drs. Roy and Dr. Ducharme, and here's what they had to say.
Welcome, everyone, to our weekly Vizient COVID-19 webinar series. My name is Lindsay Mayer, Senior Director in our Collaboratives Program, and I'll be your host for today's webinar again, Managing the Initial Impact. Our first set of speakers are from the Miriam Hospital. I'd like to go ahead and introduce Dr. Dean Roy, Senior Vice President of Medical Affairs and Chief Medical Officer, and Dr. Marie Ducharme, who is the Senior Vice President of Patient Care Services and Chief Nursing Officer. So Dr. Roy and Dr. Ducharme, the floor is now yours.
Thank you.
Thank you. So good morning or good afternoon all, depending on where you are. We're thrilled to be here and appreciate Vizient's reach this morning. And it's great to get a few minutes out of our Hospital Incident Command Center today to talk to so many of our colleagues. So just a little bit about the Miriam Hospital. We are a 247-bed hospital. We're part of a larger healthcare system, a Lifespan healthcare system located in Providence, Rhode Island. I would call your attention to our number of emergency department visits, and those were the visits that were seen. So it's in excess of 76,000 visits in a 247-bed hospital, a very robust emergency department. And why I call that out is because as we look at surge plans, we were living in surge prior to even thinking about large influxes of patients. And we do have a pretty robust outpatient volume as well as our inpatient beds.
We are considered to be a complex hospital within the Vizient network.
Yes. And so preparations. We really began our preparations in the beginning of January, the beginning to middle of January. We began phone calls and meetings at a system level the week of January 20th. So just for, I know time has either gone by quickly or gone by slowly, depends on where you are, but the virus was only identified on January 7th. So within 2 weeks, we had started to prepare for the inevitable. And again, on January 20th, really some new cases were starting in China, but not a whole lot of activity. By through January and then into February, we started system planning to set up our hospital incident command. And we were ready and good to go on Friday, February 28th. We had all our appointments and we had our charts and we had our paperwork in, and we were going to set up for Monday. And on that same day, the first case presented to our hospital. So we set up a day earlier on the Sunday. Dr. Roy and I in the HIC structure share incident command responsibilities on the 3-deep list. For this particular event, at the system level, all of our CMOs are serving in operations sections chief because the medical branch is under that, and there is obviously such a huge and integral component for this particular event. So we are together every day in this structure and have been very successful thus far. Communications, obviously, a huge part of what we're doing. So as I said, we set up our incident command on March 1st. And by March 3rd, our communications department and a lot of clinical experts and folks had already developed an intranet page with user guides for patients under investigation. So folks had a lot of information at the ready, but they wanted to know more, right? We're, as I said, a 247-bed hospital, a small to moderate-sized hospital where, you know, you walk down the hall, we know almost everybody, we're accustomed to meeting in groups and discussing the issues at hand. We're really a relationship-based organization. So the intranet was wonderful and all of these clinical guidelines people welcomed, but they wanted to hear more. So I had my CNO roundtables, and Dr. Roy had his with the medical staff, and we had our infection control medical director who had set up some roundtables. But what we realized early on is they were standing room only. We were squeezed in like sardines. And that was not following social distancing guidelines. Now, frankly, in the beginning of March, you didn't hear a lot about social distancing guidelines, believe it or not. I know it's only March 18th, but we knew that putting that many people in a room with a potential pandemic coming, that that was not a good thing. So as I said, we had our website. We started to communicate via a daily bulletin, which again is wonderful, but we really had to stress to people that people that lived kind of in an once a week email world or an occasional visit to the website, that this is one of our most important methods of communication right now. And all of the information that was coming out of our incident command centers and all of the clinical guidelines and decisions that were being made by our infection preventionists and infection control providers and directors were critical and necessary for them to be looking at daily before they cared for patients, that the policies that are authored on March 4th or 5th may change on March 6th or 7th, not because they were flawed in any way, but because the evidence is changing, our situations and context is changing. So it's really been critically important for us to convey to the staff, for us to safely care for them and for them to safely care for their patients, that there really is a large onus on them to frequent their email and frequent the website.
I think that's one of the key takeaways, is to make sure that your organization has a source of truth, because literally the information will change within the day before the day is finished. As far as other early lessons that we learned, know and monitor your burn rate for your PPEs. For organizations that haven't really gotten started with a lot of this, there are shortages of PPEs really throughout the world right now. When we started, we looked at our burn rate, our use rate of our masks and gowns and so forth, and we found that within our five hospital system, we were using roughly about 3,500 to 4,000 masks per day. So we started conservation efforts very early, and we cut that daily use rate down to less than 1,000 masks per day throughout the system. We felt pretty good about that. And then as the virus information progressed and it looked more and more likely that we were going to start getting towards where we're going to see community spread, we thought about, should we have our patients mask as they come into the hospital? We're still in influenza season, and we thought that made a lot of sense. So we instituted a policy that you had to stop, Purell, and mask as a patient or a visitor coming into the hospital. And that was a disaster. Within that one day, that 24-hour period, we saw approximately a full previous max burn rate of about 4,000 masks go within the system in about a 24-hour period. There were boxes that were being stolen by visitors. There were also reports going on around the country of breaking and supplies being stolen. So we went to centralizing our supplies, putting it under lock and key, controlling access. We did away with that policy of having visitors mask. We contemplated having our hospital staff mask, but we did not pull the trigger on that at that point in time. Looking at our level 2 masks, those were the masks that we were having the visitors wear when they came, when they had suspicion of influenza-like illnesses. We were monitoring those for shortages as well. Our level 3 masks were surgical masks. Those were being sequestered and allocated in surgery, and those numbers were being controlled very tightly. N95s, critically important for those places that have not started to see people under investigation or COVID actual positive patients. We ran into some issues as we started the process with our getting people fitted out for N95s. It turns out that a lot of our providers, either it's been many years since they were fitted and they've had changes in their face in terms of weight gain, weight loss, people, physicians growing beards, These were big issues that we saw. We've strongly encouraged shaving beards to allow for a proper fit of the N95s, because if you need to go into a COVID patient's room and you can't use an N95 because you can't get the proper fit, then you would need to use a capper or a papper to protect yourself from the aerosolized virus. In our organization, we don't have a large supply of cappers and pappers, and therefore it's a very closely husbanded resource. And that's one of the things that I would recommend as well, is to make sure you understand very closely what your resources are. And then lessons learned over the weeks with our cappers and pappers is we've seen a fair bit of breakage, whether that's older equipment, that's carelessness on the user, but we've had to take a not insignificant number of pappers out of circulation because of that issue. Our face shields, if you don't have a capper and a papper, a N95 and a face shield with a gown is considered to be okay for max precautions. We were running low on face shields over the weeks, and we weren't sure when we were going to be able to get supplies, so we instituted a cleaning mechanism for our face shields and started to reuse those. We've extended our N95 usage instead of having it as a single interaction, which is how we were before COVID, to having our staff take off their N95, put it in a bag, and we have a process around that, and then that bag is secured to the room that the patient's in on the outside of the room, and whenever that staff member needs to go back in, they reuse that N95 for that patient. The other thing that when we had our first patient that was a documented positive COVID, we noticed a very significant increase in our burn rate. Within our hospital, that one patient basically used up about half of our typical burn rate for PPEs within a 24-hour period. So Dr. Sexton last week talked about the difficulties in identifying, isolating, and then in making sure that you inform your infection control counterparts when you have a patient with COVID. That's also changed over the time that we've been dealing with this. It used to be that travel history was the number one identifying factor. The latest thing that I've heard is that about half of our patients that we're seeing in Rhode Island, travel history is one of still a reasonable screening tool. About half of our patients are still screening positive for travel history. The other half seems to be community spread, so I don't think we're in widespread community spread here, but we are seeing it in limited numbers. The biggest education for me in my role is understanding the physical plant of the hospital. I never thought when I went to medical school and surgery training that I would get to be very knowledgeable about HVAC and balancing airflows and what it takes to make a negative pressure room and how do you monitor that. But it's critically important that your facilities director and your senior leadership intimately understand the HVAC and your physical plant of your hospital. We have an older building and there are some limitations. We tried to expand a number of negative pressure rooms with individual HEPA units. And one of the things I learned was that you couldn't unbalance the airflow by having a large number of negative pressure rooms on one side, because you may not be able to keep up with the air inflow might not be able to keep up with the outflow that you're pulling out with your negative pressure. So you had to balance that out. Some of those issues, our facilities director has been vitally important in helping us do that. We have a surge plan for how we go about expanding our resources in different novel uses of some of the different physical areas within our hospital. We're creating a negative pressure ward. There's some of the nuances around that is that the entire ward is negative pressure, but each individual room in there is positive pressure to the corridor. So it basically means that when we pull the trigger on that, we will be cohorting our COVID patients in that one unit, but we won't be able to co-locate PUIs with COVID patients. So there's some of those nuances that I think you need to make sure that you understand about your physical plant. And then the other thing would be how to protect your staff and patients from exposure risks. And you know, there's been lots of guidance from the CDC and our departments of health. And those, you have to make sure that you're following that, because the guidance changes sometimes from day to day. And then the CDC and the Department of Health guidance may not necessarily be completely in congruence. And then we rely heavily on our infection control experts. I think the suggestion that I would make would be use your CDC guidance and your Department of Health guidance as your floor, and you can be more aggressive than that in terms of your efforts to mitigate and contain, but that will be your floor for intervention.
And leading the efforts, that seems like the right thing to do in a pandemic. And I'm proud of the things that our organization has done, our system has done, because I really think that we've led the way in a lot of things at both our affiliate system and state level. But it wasn't easy. Dr. Roy has just gone through some of the conservation of PPE. Staff were accustomed to conserving N95s and using for the same patient with a couple of entries to the rooms, but the face shields and some of the other conservation has been hard for staff, and they want to make sure that they're safe, and they hear from other colleagues in other parts of Rhode Island or New England that, oh, our hospital doesn't have to do that. Why don't you get a fresh mask with every patient that you're seeing? And that was the beginning. Again, we're looking at a lot of these things were the beginning of March, very few cases in the state, one or two. And I'm glad that we had those conservation efforts at that time now. And I think people are understanding of them, but not everybody was at the time. Same with the visitation restrictions. We were the first system in the state to restrict visitors, and we were restricting all visitors except for end of life and unique patient situations, guardians or other types in our adult areas, PD and maternity. We don't have here at the Miriam Hospital. Those were a little different at our system level, but they were very restrictive. Of our 275 patients the day we initiated this, I think 15 had allowances for visitation. At the system level, we prohibited all international travel for professional reasons and highly discouraged even domestic travel at that point. We restricted large gatherings. And again, I think we were one of the first in our state. We had a gala that was coming up for our children's hospital, Hasbro Children's Hospital, in our system. And nobody had even talked about, as I said, social distancing or canceling large events or numbers of people at events. But we had 100 of our providers and nurses and 700 other colleagues and friends of the hospital going to a large gala, and several days after we had the discussion. And we did cancel that with the support of both our director of health, who is an infectious disease provider, and our governor at the time. So I think that was one of the first in the state. And then Dean talked a little bit about the infrastructure, but again, we really started very early on to say, how do we expand our infrastructure to care for patients, ideally in negative pressure? We know the CDC recommends negative pressure, but allows other types of care. But we really wanted to look at how do we look at our infrastructure and our surge plans to maximally care for the patients. And as I said, our surge planning was pretty significant. Now, we have experienced, as I'm sure a lot of states that have their departments of health have discouraged people from coming into the hospital if they're not ill. Fortunately, a little bit of our volume has abated compared to where we were. So our surge plans are working at the moment.
And along the lines of the conservation of PPEs, one of the things that we are actively looking into right now through some our lead infection control physician and some of his colleagues that are in the Netherlands and Sweden is looking at our N95s and can we re-sterilize those, even though that's a somewhat controversial thing at this point in time. What we're looking at is to conserve, so use it, sterilize it, and then store it in case we get to the situation where we truly run out. And then the option is, do we use one of these sterilized masks or do without? And the fear is that, based on the experience of some of his colleagues in Netherlands and Sweden, is that there may be a time when they're truly running out of masks. So we want to make sure that we have options available as long as we possibly can. As far as the policies are concerned, medical and surgical societies are creating policies, but those policies are generally sort of blanket statements that are designed to cover the entire country. But I think you have to look within your local community. And just based on the survey that we saw at the beginning of the presentation, with 71% of places around organizations that are on the call canceling surgeries and so forth, I think that that's being a reasonable way to look at it. You have to balance the prevalence of the disease in your state versus the resources that it would take to care for the patients and then risk to the patients to make a proper decision. I think you can use those as guidance. I think you can use your Department of Health as guidance. Some places, the Department of Health has put a moratorium on elective procedures. We have not done that in Rhode Island, and we actually today started to limit our upper endoscopy, bronchoscopy, some of the aerosol-generating procedures. Again, more from an elective standpoint, more to preserve the N95 masks than anything else. We're still doing other elective operations, but we look at that on a day-by-day basis between the CEO of our hospital system and the chiefs and chairs of all of our departments within the hospital. From a patient experience standpoint, so the lessons that we learned from the first patient that we had, the initial guidance was avoid high flow oxygen, intubate early, and I do believe that early intubation is in our algorithm still, but it's with some judicious judgment. Obviously, you'd want to do this under the most controlled circumstances possible because of risk of aerosolization and then exposure to staff with an emergency intubation. But we don't really have a hard, fast number or guidance as to exactly when that is. I think some of that depends as to your resources, what you have available, whether you have anesthesia available 24/7. We do not. So we had our first patient come in, and that patient deteriorated very rapidly, basically going from floor-level care to requiring fairly high support of mechanical ventilation within about a 12 to 16-hour period. The lessons that we learned there was we started out to put the patient on the floor, but then quickly realized that that wasn't going to be the best course if the patient continued to worsen. And we were fortunate that the patient was in the ICU, started to deteriorate. We had a plan ready for getting that patient intubated. And with our ICU doctor using a capper to be as safe as possible, got that patient intubated safely. In terms of treatment, with the rapid deterioration and some literature out there about using Remdesivir, we were granted compassionate use of Remdesivir, and the patient actually responded very rapidly with that treatment. I don't know if that's going to be something that's an anecdotal experience or it's going to hold true, but that was our experience with that particular agent. In terms of staffing and levels of care, this was one of those issues that with our first patient, we had concerns from the staff and then making sure that we had the patient in the optimum environment because we didn't want a patient that we knew going through the hospital, not intubated and potentially aerosolizing and exposing our staff in our positive pressure environments. There are lots of discussions around ED, floor, and ICU in terms of the transfers. And then discharge issues that came up were that some of our skilled nursing facilities refused to take some of our COVID patients or even PUIs before they were tested, or any patient at this point in time that doesn't have some documentation that they're COVID negative, and our Department of Health is working with us to address that particular issue. And the Department of Health, there was some issues with our Department of Health in terms of wanting to make sure that our first patient was tested negative before discharging the patient, but with close discussions, that issue was resolved.
And so deployment of resources. As I said, we have a robust plan in place, but some of our hospital census has decreased. We have significantly decreased our ambulatory visit volume. And as Dr. Roy outlined, our surgical cases as well on a very selective basis, those that are requiring high levels of PPE or those that have generation of aerosols that would create problems for the staff as well. There are some union implications at a system level. So as we look at our labor pool in our incident command center, it's really at the affiliate level because we are not a union hospital and our larger flagship hospital is a union hospital. But we really are just looking at the labor pool in a concerted fashion today. We haven't had to before now. And really, fortunately, the way that we're looking at it today is providing work for those that are not working in our ambulatory clinics versus being in a position that we had to pull them out prematurely. So we're actually in a pretty good position from a deployment of human resources. Some student restrictions, nursing students, we did not want them to be duplicative, multiple people entering a room, multiple people using PPE. We have kept them on for other types of experiences that we could provide them and help that they could provide. But that's, as schools are out, that's slowly just taking care of itself. And the same with the resident GME rotations as well.
We've looked at our developing our ethics committee, and we started that about 2 to 3 weeks ago at all of the affiliates. And we have a draft guidance for if and when the time comes to talk about rationing care. We're hopefully well away from that, and hopefully we'll never get there.
Yes. And as was mentioned, all of the schools are closed in our area. So we've started a child care survey through our HR department just to see if there are any folks that are disadvantaged by the closing of schools and have had to stay home. We're waiting the results of that. But on an operational basis, we really haven't had a lot of folks out because their kids are home, which we were very surprised at and obviously very pleased. But because so many other, you know, the spouse or someone they live with are working remotely from home, we haven't experienced increasing absences related to this.
You know, you need to be aware of your social stressors. We worked with our psychiatric chair and department to have a resource of or some of our psychologists and psychiatrists to serve as a stress counselor for healthcare workers, and that's something that is just getting set up today, as a matter of fact. But we've been working on that for about 2 weeks in terms of operationalizing it.
And certainly we have our employee assistance programs, but we do want these kind of three deep resources for folks because we understand that access to support, some of these supports may become limited as folks are working remotely or even closing offices. So looking at our internal resources, as Dr. Roy outlined, to really address any staff support concerns that folks have, either in the workplace or at home, the fears, the apprehension, the family fears and apprehension, and we're really trying to keep a close eye on that. You can go to any website right now, the CDC, your local Department of Health, and there are so many resources, right? And so that's an important thing. Key principles. And this is what I feel like we are trying to do on a daily basis through our command center, through our operations, is promoting a sense of safety, a sense of self and community efficacy, a sense of connectedness, which is really difficult with our social distancing at the same time, calming and hope. And so that has really been, I think, a lot of Dr. Roy and I's role in the organization. We're not your infection prevention specialists. We're not your IC folks, but we're hoping that we're meeting our organization's needs in our efforts. And thank you very much for your time.
So it looks like we have just a few minutes left. We got a lot of questions here. So let's go ahead and dig into just a few. So are you focusing, you know, more on continuous 24-hour infusions rather than intermediate infusions? So any thoughts to that? And I'll ask Dr. Roy and Ducharme to start us off.
It's a good question. I'll be honest with you, since I'm not on the front lines of actually treating it, I would defer that to your infection and ID providers at your local institutions. It's a good thought, though, and I think choice of agents to extended spectrum or once daily does make some sense if it is applicable for whatever underlying diseases you're treating other than COVID.
Yeah, it's an excellent question, but has not been discussed here.
About the face mask, are you reusing or conserving face shields? And then maybe a tag on question to the face shields. Someone wanted to know, what solution are you using to clean face shields?
Okay, I'll start as Dr. Roy looks up the solutions. I know we're using our PDI wipes, but yes, we are. Just this week, we've started to cleanse the face shield. And as I said, we went back and forth with the FDA requirements around the, I believe we landed on the purple, but yes, we are cleaning them.
And Dr. Roy Ducharme, are you cohorting patients in one unit?
We are not yet. We've talked about that extensively. At this time, we have 4 positive patients, so we are able, and they've been at different levels of care. So we've had a couple in our critical units, a couple on our med-surg units. We have surge plans for a couple of different areas, depending on the volume. But at this time, we have not needed to put them in any area, but if the volumes were higher, certainly there would be efficiencies and potentially, you know, conservation of PPE. So we have plans.
How are you handling any screening for third-party staff that are delivering products through docs on your facility? So any efforts underway to screen those type of individuals that are coming onto campus?
Yes, we screen all of them. We only have one. We've closed all of our entrances. So they're badge only with a security person at each of the entrance, except for the front entrance where there is a nurse, a social worker, and a security guard. So anybody who enters the organization is screened. We've also limited some of our vendors that don't need to be here and using our system, our vendor support system, to do some of that proactively. But anybody who presents to the hospital is screened. And if their visit is not necessary,
discouraged to promote.
Yes.
This is an interesting question. How are you handling job interviews that were already scheduled?
Yeah, that's a great question. We have been doing them remotely, either by Skype or phone interview when we can. Certainly the screening interview is done in that way, but even some of the initial interviews are done in that way. And then if we really are close to a final offer, we may bring them in. But we're being very selective as to areas that really need to fill that position at this time. And if we can hold, we are waiting.
Yeah, and social distancing when we do have in-person interviews.
Yes.
Great. Thank you.
Great work happening at Miriam Hospital. I want to thank Lindsay Mayer, Dr. Roy, and Dr. Ducharme for that look at the battle they're waging in the front lines against COVID-19. I sincerely hope this has both inspired and informed you in your own efforts in dealing with this virus. Please join us for other Modern Practice podcasts on the Vizient Medical Leadership Channel. I'm Dr. Tom Villanueva. Thank you for listening.